Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am interviewing a woman who is actually larger than life. I know we use that expression a lot, and it's sort of casually, but in the case of Mary Testa, it really is true. Mary Testa is a presence. She has done and is doing virtually everything that can be done on a theater stage, and she has done it better than most people. If there's any downside with Mary, it's that we don't see nearly enough of her. I interviewed her when she was here in Sarasota with Love, Loss, and What I Wore at the Oslo. She has gone on now to other greener pastures. This is an extraordinary interview with an extraordinary woman. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
That it can and will change your life if you are able to look back and discover what you might have to have had to deny. Of course, if you've been listening to the show, you know that I believe that virtually none of us gets out of childhood whole. That is, that we are born with capacities, abilities, skills, tendencies, leanings, and that depending on the family into which we found ourselves, the culture into which we were born, the peer group into which we were dumped, some of those qualities, abilities, leanings don't work. The family, the culture, the peer group, the religion says, no, 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 no. We don't like that. We don't want that. That isn't what we are. And so you find yourself very, very young, at odds with yourself. I am an exuberant, happy, joyous, loud human being in a culture that says the children are seen but not heard. I am a thoughtful, serious, intellectual, introverted child who found him or herself in a family that wants to tell jokes and make pranks and be loud and isn't interested in your idea of yourself. So, what do we do when we find that what we are is not bringing us what we need? What we need when we are children is, you know, to use the overused phrase, unconditional love, unconditional acceptance. What does that mean? That means that everything that I am is okay by them. In fact, everything that I am is terrific by them. I'm not saying, of course, that you don't have to socialize a child, that you don't have to stop it from running into the gutter because it's seen a ball there that it wants, that you don't have to caution it. There are some things that you don't blurt out because they're hurtful or unpleasant. Of course, children have to be helped to understand how to get by in their culture without getting hurt. But that's very different from that thing that you are is bad and wrong. That thing that you are is terrific and wonderful. It may not actually work in this situation. You might want to figure out when to expose that and when to keep it under wraps, but you don't want to lose it because it's terrific. And that kid who wants to run out after the ball into the street, certainly you want to caution it to be sure a car isn't coming, but maybe that's a famous football player who's going to have to run after that ball no matter what's coming at him. So you're beginning to get the point that the qualities that are natural to us, we deserve them. We deserve the right to develop them, to be proud of them. There's a Yiddish word for this. I'm sorry for those of you who may not have ever heard it. It means delight in, be proud of. It's to quell. We want to quell in everything we are, and we only quell in everything we are if those who have the power to tell us what's right and what's wrong have quelled in us. The problem is that most parents have not gotten that unconditional love, unconditional acceptance, quelling in what they are, so that they cannot possibly have given it to their children. So when you don't get that, what happens? Well, generally speaking, we figure out a way to pretend we don't have it. This is a capacity of childhood. This is a gift of being a human being. We figure out how to pretend that we are not what we are. Another example, of course, is that children are completely trusting. Children don't know that there's any reason not to trust. I know a terrible story that this young man told me. That of his father, who put him on a table and said, "Jump." And this little boy jumped and the father didn't catch him. And the father told him that the reason for that was that he wanted him to learn that the world was not a trustworthy place. And of course, this young man learned that lesson in no uncertain terms and was therefore unable to trust. But the part of the story that I want you to hear is that when Daddy said jump, this little boy jumped. Because children are born trusting. And until they are taught to, quote, South Pacific, you have to be carefully taught. You have to be carefully taught to not be who you are. So, most of us come out of childhood having learned that sometimes most of who we are is not okay. And we have the capacity to bury the ability to be that. That's the thing that's perhaps difficult for people to understand. I have not yet said that I am a psychotherapist whose practice currently is entirely on the telephone. Clients quite often say to me when they describe this quality that they have come in to ask me to help them get rid of, they say, but that's just who I am. And of course they believe it absolutely, having first had to convince a parent or a peer group or a religious person or a cultural person, then having convinced themselves, this is just who I am. I am someone who doesn't trust. I am someone who doesn't have spontaneous eruptions of joy. I am someone who isn't interested in learning. It's not true, but they don't know it. The capacity to love learning, to have spontaneous eruptions of joy, to trust, is there, still, hidden in what I call undercover. So I wrote a book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And in it I describe the qualities which we are now pretending are us, those things that people say, well, that's just who I am, as our cover story as in spy, a story which we present so as not to be in danger. Of course, the difference between the spy and us is that the spy knows it's a story and it's not the truth. We think it's the truth. And I say that those qualities, the qualities of spontaneous eruption, of the love of ideas, the ability to trust, have gone undercover. They are not gone. They're hiding undercover, protected by our unconscious, and available to us, although simply knowing that is not enough. I don't want you to think that if you're sitting at home saying, oh, yeah, you know, they have stories about me when I was a kid that was the first one up in the morning and running out to greet the day, and, you know, somehow I can't drag myself out of bed now. I don't know what that is. It's just been the way I've been. Well, that capacity of joy in the morning, that's undercover. But just knowing it, that doesn't make us have access to it. It's not that simple. So, if you're thinking that there's a quality that you have had to hide, and you're curious about how you might be able to get access to it, I talk about some of those, some of the ways you can do that in these shows, but also you can find that information in my book, which you can find on my website, thelynshow.com. THELYNNE, don't leave the E out of Lynn, SHOW, thelynshow.com. You can buy the book online. Or if you want to talk to me about it, you can click on email me, tell me that you want to, you have a question, maybe you're interested in going into therapy on the phone. There's an article called Psychotherapy on the Go on my website as well, which you can read. Or you can just keep listening. I will be talking on and off about this subject because it is what the Lynn Show is about. The other thing that I do in my show in order to make the point that that it is important to be who you really are is I interview artists, people who make their living or their life with an art, because in order to do that in our culture, really, you have to. It has to be who you really are. We make it so difficult for artists to survive. And so if you've been listening, you have heard stories over and over and over again about the commitment, the dedication to the art, the obstacles that are encountered by virtually every artist in every medium. Today, I am airing an interview that I did with Mary Testa. And as I said in the opening, Mary was here with four other glowing female presences in the play Love, Loss, and What I Wore, which ran for a very long time off-Broadway and then ran for a short time in Sarasota, Florida. And as I say in the beginning, well, someplace in this interview, Mary gets the most attention. She gets the biggest laughs. She gets the biggest applause. And she said she had the best lines. You'll hear her say that. But that's not why. It's because she is so powerful. She's so very there. She's so very in the material. She's giving it everything she's got, and she's got so much to give. So that's how she is in this interview. She's incredibly candid. She's very, very there. What you see is what you got, which is, of course, what the Lynch Show is all about. And in Mary's case, there were a number of obstacles that she had to confront and overcome and deal with in order to be what, as you'll hear her say, she was doing somersaults with the company when she was two. So in order to be the person that she was at two and bring that amazing talent and energy and passion to a stage for the rest of us to see, she had to keep doubling back on herself, finding herself. One of the remarkable talents that she has is an extraordinary voice, and she's going to talk at the end of the interview about the show Queen of the Mist, which was written for her. And I was able to take some snippets from Queen of the Mist. These are not the best quality that I have ever done in this show, but I really wanted you to hear her voice. I wanted you to get a sense of the amazing talent when you listen to the interview. So right before the interview, I'm going to play a little snippet, and then the very last thing I'm going to do is go out on yet another little snippet from Queen of the Mist with the amazing Mary Testa. And right after I play it, you'll hear the interview.
And the world gives me nothing that I don't give myself. The world offers nothing, and so I'll serve myself. You go freaking leaders and bow bottom feeders, I'll take what I want and I'll take even more. You haters of thinkers, you haters of dreamers, I'll laugh at the tiger and more. There is greatness in me, it would make you shock. There is greatness in me, it's a full-time job.
That is correct. Oh, thank you very much.
There you go.
I am here with the technologically savvy.
Not really. I do know how to press record.
I got it. Mary Testa. In the mezzanine of the Oslo. And Mary is here as one of the ensemble doing Love, Loss, and What I Wore at the Oslo in Sarasota, Florida. And I won't tell anybody, if you don't tell anybody, that you get the most applause and the biggest laughs and the most response.
Well, I have good pieces. You know, I have,
you have
the
good
big
pieces, but please.
Pieces.
Please.
Well, you know.
Just say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Right.
And it's quite clear what you make the art with which you make your life and your living.
Oh, thank you, yes.
It's right. And it's acting and theater?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
Oh, I sing as well, so I do a lot of concert work. I do everything. I do theater, television, movies, concert work, web series, all kinds of things.
You're a performer?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm an artist.
And you're an artist in the best sense of the word.
Yes.
Great. Okay, so I ask one question.
Okay.
And it is, how did it start? Which is to say, not your first job, but when was the first moment in your childhood that it occurred to you or someone said to you or you had an experience that suggested that performing, that singing, that dancing, that entertaining, that having an influence any of that would be something you would want to do. Do you know?
I think it wasn't a tangible thing for me, but I know that the story, the classic stories, family stories, was that I used to, when I was like two, do somersaults for the company. You know, whoever my, it's, you know, so the entertainment aspect
right.
was instilled in me not early. And I've always enjoyed being sort of boisterous and saying things that everybody's thinking but won't say.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of attention sort of got into my bones.
Well, so, you know, so it's let me entertain you at a very young age?
I guess, but it's more like being bold.
Yes, I see it. And making, having an impact,
yeah,
right, or causing a reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think my own brand of it is also making everybody comfortable at the same time while doing it. Not alienating people,
yes,
but making people feel drawn in by it, by my audacity.
Yeah,
you
know? Sort of creating the environment in which other people can too.
Yeah.
Am I making that right?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So I think I felt that as an early, in my early
okay,
ages.
So, of course, what I want to know is where would that have come from? Not everybody feels that.
I think it came from being, you know, I did it when I was a little kid, and I'm not quite sure where it came from. I mean, my parents were outgoing, nice people and fun people.
Well, they certainly, one of the things, well, there are a number of ways this can happen, but once you've done it, if you don't do that, Mary.
Yeah.
You know, if
yeah.
you get, you know, you didn't get that, you must have gotten.
I think I got, you know, don't show off or things like that, but I don't think it stopped me. And I also, I think a large part of it, of my detriment and my wonderfulness.
Asset. Right, right.
Is that I went to Catholic school and was pretty beat up on by the nuns. And so, not physically, but mentally.
No, no, no.
And so I think that I made a definite, I wanted to be my own person, and they want you to be what, you know, everything
yeah, yeah, yeah.
that you're not. And I think I, in order to defy them, I became even more.
Okay, so, but you know that everybody does not respond to that kind of squashing.
Right.
With, I'll show you.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't do that, so... Did you have siblings?
I had a sister. I still have an older sister, 4 years older. Very different from me. She's very funny in her own way, but she's not as outgoing. Well, that's not really true, but then, when
right,
we were children,
right.
I was the more
you were the one.
Outgoing one.
You
yes.
were the one,
yeah.
right. And, well, it's fascinating because it clearly, it either came with the genes or something very early caused you to believe that you could do that, you should do that,
mm-hmm.
and more than that, that it became something that defined you?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that's really true, you know. My personality took first place over my looks, because I was everything I wasn't supposed to be. You know,
yeah.
when I was in Catholic school, my nuns were all Irish. I was an Italian girl. I was one of a few Italian kids in my class. They despised me for that. So they were awful. I mean, I have so many friends who went to Catholic school, and the stories are just legendary. But, you know, so I had curly hair at a time when straight hair was the thing to have. I had boobs when nobody had boobs. I had glasses. You know, I had everything you weren't supposed to have. So instead of letting that defeat me,
yeah.
I just said, well, nobody's going to notice me physically because nobody paid attention to me physically. Nobody said, oh, what a pretty little girl you are. I had a personality that was larger than the room.
Right.
So I think that's, you know,
yeah.
that's what it was.
Well, I think that there's a reason for it, and we don't need to know what it is, but it became clear early on that that was your ticket. That was
I guess,
right,
yeah.
that was the currency that right that was going to get you through life.
Yeah,
right?
I guess it's true. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to sit looking at a microscope. You know, I'm going to go out where there's entertainment
right,
to
yeah,
be
yeah. right. Okay.
Okay. So I guess that's it.
So when did you start Catholic school? How old were you when you...
I was seven.
Seven.
And I went slammed right into Catholic school because I did not go to preschool or any kindergarten or anything.
So this is your first school experience?
I slammed right into just awful, you know, horrible. My parents, to their credit, were really under the assumption, and possibly partly true, that it was a better education. Mm-hmm. The Catholic school was a better education. And, you know, I was a straight-A student, with the exception of conduct. I always got D's. Straight-A, and then D for conduct. Always, 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 yeah.
That must have pissed them off, too, that you got straight A's.
Yes, it did.
Right.
Because they couldn't relegate me. And there were plenty of kids in my class who were not so bright and were troublesome, so that they could really just be mean to them and slap them around and do things to them. And the kids had no recourse. I had a brain that was always working overtime that was like, I'll get you back. You know, kind of. Which is what I did. But, you know, it's detrimental to me, too, because it caused a lot of problems for me, you know, that I'm realizing in adult life,
yes.
You know, of trust issues and things like that, of trusting someone to help me out. I always thought I had nobody who had my back. So, maudlin, but, you know.
No, I don't. I think it's not. I think, and actually it's important because it must have helped to form who you are and how you got where you got and what you did.
I think so.
But as I think you're beginning to point out, is that it's a double-edged sword.
Absolutely.
You know, on the one hand, you can do anything and you will do everything and nobody will stop you. And on the other hand, you have to do everything.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So, Catholic school from the time you're seven to...
When I graduated eighth grade. And then I got accepted into a Catholic high school that was very exclusive in Newport, Rhode Island, with five kids in each class.
Wow.
And I said to my parents, no way.
Wow.
I'm done. I'm done going to church, too. And they were like, do, you know, whatever you want to do. They were, you know, because we had to go to church like three times a week when you're in Catholic school, and every Sunday you're supposed to go to church. So I was like, I'm done with this whole thing.
Wow.
And so I
they didn't went to, know when they sent you off to school that they were...
They had no idea until about the sixth grade, because I would come home every day and tell them.
Oh,
awful. So I went to a public high school, but the bad thing about that was I didn't know anybody.
Yes, of course.
So I went to a high school where they all grew up together.
Of course.
And I knew nobody. So that was tough, too. So I really wasn't comfortable in school until college.
Wow.
Mm.
So you compensated for that, for all of the things that they did to you that made it difficult for you. You compensated for it by being bigger and bigger and bolder and bolder and smarter and smarter.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, it's just a gift. You could do it. Not everyone, as you pointed out, could have done it. Not everybody was smart enough. Not everyone had the talent. No, not everyone had the chutzpah.
Right.
You know, to do it, so you had it, but it must have been lonely in its way.
Yeah, there's moments, yeah totally.
I think school is tough for a lot of kids for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, but so did you do any singing, dancing, entertaining in any of this?
My mother sang, and so I always sang with her when I was a kid, so I had a natural voice. And I sang, I have a classic story. We lived right across the street from a golf course, and one day, I think I was about nine, my mother had gone to the store. She said, I'll be right back. So I was in the house singing at the top of my lungs, and we were right across in the second tee off, and the second hole. And I sang this big number, big finish, and I heard applause. And I looked out the window, and there were like 20 men who were like, what? And I was so mortified. I sat under the window, pulled the shade down, and sat under the window until my mother got home. But so I realized, that I kind of have a power. So my grammar school and my high school had absolutely no artistic anything in it.
Oi.
But I started sort of doing stuff after high school and in college. That's when I pursued.
Well, that's pretty amazing. I mean that you started with the somersaults at two, that you knew that you could sing by nine, that you didn't get an opportunity. Did you think about that at all? Did
no.
you daydream that? Nothing?
No.
No. Did you have any thoughts at all about what you were going to do when you got out
no.
of this? You were
no.
just doing one foot over in
yeah,
front of the other.
Yeah, just one foot in front of the other, and I've kind of always been that way. High school is when I went, what do I want to do with myself? And I have stories that I tell in every interview, but this is one of my classics. One day I just went, should I be a lawyer or should I be an actor? And I went, I think I'll be an actor because I don't have to go to school as long. That was literally the day. That was
I
the decision.
Believe you.
And then I just followed that path. And I do that. My boyfriend always says to me, don't you have a plan? And I go, no, I don't think that way.
I don't need to.
I never have. I said, I'm like, and I just had an interview in the paper on Sunday, and this is from the interview too, but I am really like a pinball machine. I'm like a pinball. I go, and whatever I hit up against, I do.
Yeah.
And I don't plan, like, okay, next year I want to do this, and next year I want to do that, and then I want to have this by this time, and I want to have that. I don't think that way. I never have.
No, and it's worked for you.
I suppose, and I suppose it's double-edged as well. Like, maybe if I had a plan, things would be different. I don't know. But that's just not the way I think, so.
It's an interesting question. I tend to believe that your way of doing it makes much more sense. With the possible exception of if someone has a plan, they are flexible.
Right.
But generally speaking, when people have plans, they have it in stone. And so when they rub up against something that they could have, they don't go there.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Inspiration. You miss inspiration.
You miss everything.
But I think that the bad thing about not having a plan is that you don't, like, I don't know if I know how to dream big.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Because I don't think of the biggest thing that can happen. I have just one foot in the next thing. So I think that's the detriment to not having a plan. Because if you have a plan, you can dream real big.
Okay, so having said that, I know that it's not who you are and it's not how you've ever acted and all that stuff, but could you, having said, I think that there's an advantage to having to dreaming big.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ask yourself to dream big?
I occasionally do, and it makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
Anxious. I'll bet it does.
I don't quite know how to...
What to do with it.
What to do with it.
Yeah.
Interesting. I never really thought about this. This is an interesting conversation because I never really put all this...
You never took it further.
No.
Yeah. But it makes... It makes perfect sense, your inability to what you're calling dream big, given all that stuff that happened to you in your childhood. I mean, you were literally having to deal with what was in front of you every minute.
Yeah.
You couldn't afford to take your eye off the ball because you were going to get hurt all over the place.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know?
I was going to be humiliated
or embarrassed, neglected.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
All that shit, mm-hmm. which, you know, I mean, so you created an M.O., that focused on what was in front of you, and that's very efficient, actually.
Yeah.
You know? So, you don't have to answer this.
Okay.
Of course, you don't have to answer anything I ask you.
Yeah.
And I'm not offended. I don't care.
Okay.
So, however, having made that caveat, do you have any awareness? This is, I'm guessing, that when you think about the big plan, the giant dream, the, you know, what if thing, that you get a little uncomfortable or anxious? That's what it seemed like you were saying. Was
yeah.
that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what are you willing to just for the moment ask yourself if you've got any idea what that anxiety is about?
Yeah, it's like a therapy session. This.
Well, you don't have to go there.
No, but
I'm
it's
curious.
Interesting.
So, but you don't have to, and I'll take all of this out.
No, you don't have to take it out. I'm perfectly comfortable with it. I just it's like I haven't thought about that. I don't know. I think that would take me a little bit more than a minute to answer.
Okay, fine.
I need to think about that.
Yeah, well, fine. It's not required. I'm curious.
Yeah,
I'm curious.
Yeah.
Because my own personal philosophical base is that if one can stay open to what the universe is offering at any moment,
mm-hmm.
to use your pinball
you
know, analogy, I think that if you can do that, then you have the best shot at actualizing everything that you can do. Because the universe will bring things that you might not have anticipated.
Right.
And if you bang into this thing, it may knock you into that thing, which couldn't have been in your grand plan because you didn't know that thing was there.
Exactly.
Right. So I think that however it occurred that you have this way of being, that it's the most efficient and the one that's mostly guaranteed to get you able to experience whatever you're able to experience, and that most people don't have that. Most people have that other thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The five-year plan.
Right, that makes sense.
You know, who do I want to be when, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Having said all that, the ability to do both is nice. I suppose that's all I wanted to say about that.
Well, I think that's good. That makes sense. And that gives me something to think about. So thank you for that.
Because I thought
about that. I thought, that's a very interesting thing, why it makes me so uncomfortable to dream big. All right. It's very interesting.
Were you able to dream a little bigger or to dream big occasionally, that would not, it seems to me, make it not possible for you to continue to carom off whatever the universe offers.
Right.
You're not going to lose that. So.
Yeah, you're right about that. So why not dream a little bigger?
All right, enough. I'm sorry.
Okay, enough.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
You have to stop me. You really have to stop me.
No, that's okay. That's good. That's good for me to think about. That's a very positive thing that came out of this.
Well, good. I'm glad. Okay, so high school, you... I don't know why. This interview just keeps knocking me off into tangents, but did you ever hear Bill Clinton say that when he was, I think, in high school, he looked in the mirror and he said, saxophone player or politician?
Did he really?
He did.
See that?
He did. But what he said, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, he said, so I'm a really good saxophone player, but I will never be the best. But I can be the best politician.
Oh, there you go. Well,
and
good.
He was. And he was, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think very many people do that, really.
No.
You know?
I know, no.
You and Bill.
Because I think I would have made a kick-ass lawyer.
Of course you would have.
Yeah, but I'm happy doing this.
Good.
Because, you know, this is...
Well, then we're happy. Because so many more people get to experience you this way.
That's true.
You know, you're a gift. Don't thank
you.
Right.
It's very
okay.
Nice.
So high school, you say lawyer or actor, and you say actor, and then what?
Then after high school, I auditioned for a special school that was in Rhode Island at the time. I don't think they have it anymore. It's called Governor's School for the Young and Gifted in the Arts, and they had theater, art, dance. They had like a bunch of programs, and it was like a 3-month school, and it was always held in different places. And I was accepted into the theater program. And
Stop. No training, no learning, no classes.
No, I went to my high school guidance counselor, who was an old woman, Mrs. I can't remember her name now. And while she was out of the room, as a matter of fact, probably before this meeting, but I snooped through all my records so that I saw my IQ, I saw my aptitude test scores, I saw everything. My aptitude test scores, business-wise, I got 1%. Artistic, I was 99%. So, I said, what should I do? I have to audition for this. I don't know. I think I had to prepare Shakespeare. So she said, well, you have to do the Quality of Mercy speech from... Merchant of Venice. Is that Merchant of Venice?
Yeah.
The Quality of Mercy. And so I was like, okay. So I just memorized the Quality of Mercy speech, and I auditioned for a wonderful actor. He's since passed away. His name was George Martin. He was going to be the teacher. He was a brilliant actor that worked a lot at Trinity Square Rep, which is a very respected regional theater in Rhode Island. And he also, over the years, worked in New York and did a lot of great work, film work, television work, all of that stuff. He saw me and apparently said, this girl's got talent. And he accepted me in the program. I don't know how good I was doing the Quality of Mercy speech, but he noticed something in me. And over the years, I would run into him, and he'd always remind me, I always looked at you, right?
I knew it.
So I did this three weeks. I don't even remember how long it was, but it was on the Barrington College campus, and I did this program. And then I wanted to go to UCLA and go into their theater department. And my father said, no, you can't leave the state. So you pick a college in Rhode Island. So I went to the University of Rhode Island.
So we picked the smallest state in the union.
Well, that's where I live.
I know, but
he wouldn't let me go out of the state. And, you know, it was fine.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I wonder what my life would be like if I had gone to UCLA. But I went to University of Rhode Island, who had a
great theater program at the time when I was there. And I majored in theater, and I took every theater course I could by the time I finished my first semester junior year. I had everything that I wanted, and I said, I'm quitting, and I'm going to move to New York. And my parents were like, you need to finish so you can get a degree. And I said, I don't want a degree. I just want to go to New York. So that's what I did. I quit. I worked 3 jobs to save up enough money. I think I had $1,000, which to me I thought was so much money at the time. This was 1976. And at September 6th, 1976, I moved to New York. While I was in college, I met a writer named William Finn, who wrote March of the Falsettos, In Trousers, March of the Falsettos. He's won multiple Tonys. I met him while I was in college, and so when I moved to New York, I started singing with him, me and 2 other girls, and that's how we all started. His first show was called In Trousers, and I was in it. That's how I sort of started. So I kind of hit the ground running. Yeah. I worked for 3 years as a waitress and a cashier to pay the bills, and then I never had to work another waitressing job again.
Right, another day, and, yeah. Another day gig.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So that's, in a nutshell, that's how it all started.
And it was just what, I mean, it so fits you.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I had never lived anywhere but my parents' house. I mean, I moved out to go to college. I lived on campus at college. But I just moved to New York.
Right.
You know,
I know.
Was really, and I must have had guardian angels, because one of the first few months I was there, someone knocked on my door, and I looked through the peephole, and it was a man, and he said, I live above you, and my wife is very sick, and I need to take her to the hospital, but I don't have any money. Can you help me? And
I had
$20 on me. That's all I had. And I opened the door, and I gave it to him, and I said, I really do need the change back. And I never saw him again.
Of course not.
And as soon as I closed the door, I went, okay.
Yeah, right.
I get it.
Right.
Without being raped or murdered.
Right. You learned the lesson.
I get it.
Right.
So it was like, here's your lesson. You don't learn it now, you're going to learn it again.
Yes, right.
So I learned it.
Right.
So then I sort of wised up.
Right.
But, I was green. I didn't know anything from the big city. So.
Well, the other thing that's sort of curious to me is your parents said you can't go out of the state, so you listened like a very good little girl.
I did.
But then, when they said you have to finish college, you were no longer that good little girl. What the hell happened in those 2 years?
And I just knew what I wanted to do, and they sort of knew that I knew what I wanted to do. And but my dad was worried about it. My dad was not happy. It took him a few years to adjust to the fact that I was living. I mean, he instantly thought that I would, become a prostitute, I think. Not because he distrusted me, but because he distrusted
the city. Right, and he figured
so, yeah, So it took him a while. My mom was always behind me because she was a thwarted singer.
Ah, yes.
So she had dreams of performing herself. So, she was always supportive. They've both always been very supportive, but my dad was a little leery.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. I mean, because your mother was a singer, but she didn't pursue it, or she married and
had children? Well, my mother was a singer, and this is a great story, too. And she and my aunt and a friend of theirs were a threesome, like the Andrews sisters. They were called the Gay Sisters. And they had made, at the time, you could go and make a record. And they made a bunch of records for boys, their brothers and boyfriends on the ships during the war. And they were good. And I actually have their recordings. And they auditioned. There was a great big talent search at the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Providence, which was a big deal. And they auditioned to win a big band contract for a year, and they won.
Wow.
And they went home and asked my grandfather, and my grandfather said no. So that was it.
Wow.
That was it.
So there was no chance that your mother was going to let your father stop you?
Probably not. Probably not. Although I don't think they had that conversation.
Yeah, even if they had.
Yeah, right. I don't think that was part of it, but yeah.
Right. So she never... So this is kind of interesting to me, because she took what Grandpa said, and she didn't go, and they didn't, none of
them
did.
Well, that was a different time.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing her. I'm just saying that wasn't an option for her.
No. No. So she got married and had kids. And
then she had one who, and she had, from the very beginning...
She had two very smart children, but one who wanted to be in show business.
Not only who wanted to be in show business, but who insisted from the very beginning on being who she was.
Yeah, kind of.
You know, there's no... Nobody could stop you.
No.
Nobody could hurt you bad enough to stop you.
No, I know. Well, that's true. They did, but, you know, that's for another conversation. But, yeah, you're right.
And here you are.
And here I am.
Right, and here you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful.
In Florida.
In Florida.
Well.
Yeah.
Not so bad. Not so bad. I am the kind of person that doesn't like to go out of town and work. I generally don't.
No.
I generally stay in New York. But the funny thing is, I just recently won a Drama Desk Award for 3 decades of excellent work.
Oh,
and
my
goodness. And for a show I did that was written for me called Queen of the Mist. And I won this award on June 5th, and I have no work in New York.
No.
No work in New York. So this came up, which is
excellent.
And
you said, phew.
I have?
Right,
yeah,
right,
work.
Right.
So, but this is very pleasant, and I had done it in New York, too. So.
Yeah. When you say this is very pleasant, do you mean doing the show or being here at the Oslo?
All of it. Yeah? It's very nice, very comfortable. They treat us very well. They take great care of us. The apartments we're staying in are great. And I was able to bring my dog and car, and I'm tool around. And, you know, it's beautiful here. So it's all great.
It's beautiful here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the other question I ask is, having given a life to this work, and... It's funny because it sounds like you started out giving a life to this work with the somersaults, and then we had a little hiatus here while you had to get old enough to get out of that thing, right? And then you have essentially given your life to this work.
I kind of have.
Yeah. Right. And so I just ask, is there anything you would say about that, about what it's like, about what you think about it, about how you feel about it, or anything at all?
Well, you know, I guess a lot of sacrifices were made. I'm not I so focused on work for so long, I never focused on, you know, children or marriage or anything like that. And I just focused on what my voice told me to do, kind of, you know. It's thrilling, and it's also hard.
Yes, it is hard.
So... I don't know what quite to say about it. I know my boyfriend and I have had discussions about it because he's, like, sometimes frustrated by the fact that he's like, you seem to just focus on your work, but I'm sort of used to doing that I do focus on my work. Not to the exclusion of him, but, you know, I do focus on my work, so.
Well, I really want you to go on because I want to hear everything you have to say about it, but I do want to say that all this focus on the work seems to have paid off. That's why you got the award. They didn't give it to you because you didn't pay attention to
your work. Well, no, that's true.
So I think it's clear to everyone, and it's not, you know, it's an honorable thing. It's an honorable
thing.
That's so nice. But I do think you're right that one cannot do everything. It's kind of like what we were talking about with the, you know, the caroming and the big picture. It is difficult.
You can't have a kid and focus completely on
your work. Well, you
just can't. You have to focus on your child.
Actually, people do, but it's not good.
I don't think that it ever works out.
No, I don't think so either.
Because I think if you have a child, your focus has to be that child. That's your number one focus.
I agree.
And so your work becomes second. I wasn't ever willing to do that, nor did I have the urge to do that.
No.
So, that's a sacrifice. I don't have siblings. You know, I don't have anybody to push me when I'm peeing in my pants. That's
right.
What I like to say. When I'm peeing in my pants, nobody's going to push my wheelchair. I don't have any kids. So, that's a sacrifice, and sort of economically is a sacrifice.
It's a challenge.
Like, you know, basically, I'm just sort of
running
away, keeping my head above water, basically.
Right.
I've had very successful years, but not in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked steadily, and I've had amazingly artistic successful years in the past 3 years, but not financially. So, you know, that's always the trade-off, too. They never come, the artistic and the commercial never match,
ever.
I mean, if they do, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So that's kind of a sacrifice, too. But I guess, you know, that's...
Yeah, for you, the the focus on the work, does it feel sweet to focus on the work? Do you know what I mean?
If the work is good, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had a tremendously artistically fulfilling time lately. But I'm worried about my
your life. Well, yeah, sure, you're worried about the future.
So
then we're back to the big dream. So of the things that you have done, what are the things that are your favorite?
The show I just recently did in December. Actually, we started last October, September, October, November. It was the November, December. We closed in December. It was a musical written for me by someone who I think is just brilliant. His name is Michael John Lacusa. I've worked on a lot of his shows, and I just think he is brilliant, and the world hasn't even caught up to him yet. And he wrote me a show, and it was my first lead. I sang everything and said everything, and it was a spectacularly beautiful experience.
Can you tell? Because I don't know about it.
No, it's definitely called Queen of the Mist.
Yes, I will get it and play pieces.
Oh, you
it
must. It's
I
absolutely extraordinary. A musical about a woman, another woman. True story, Anna Edson Taylor, who at the age of 61 in the 1900s went over Niagara Falls in a barrel of her own design and lived.
Oh, my goodness.
And did it to become famous and become rich, and neither of which happened. And she
was... You're kidding. She did it with her big dream, and that didn't happen?
She was a woman not of her time. And she became famous for a time, but because she was a woman and because she was not, you know, your classic standard of what they thought a woman should be at that time, pretty much ignored. And her feat, which everybody sort of made fun of, her brilliance was ignored. And she died a pauper, alone.
Oh, my God.
It's an amazing story, a true story, and this is what the musical is, and it's it was a tremendous thrill to be, because I've always been a supporting person, you know, and to be the lead was phenomenal, and it was a very emotional, it's a very emotional piece, so it was a real, like, wrung out every night, but it was fantastic. So I'm known, you know, mostly for doing comedy. I do everything, and I have and this sounds so snotty, but it's really true, I have an enormous talent that has never been tapped into.
Yeah.
Just little pieces have been tapped into. So to get to
do that, yeah. And the truth is, your capacity for pathos is very clear to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you can do that without any trouble at all.
Yeah, and mostly people, like I get people who see the show and they're, you're so funny.
Yeah, right.
But I made you cry. But I first made you cry, didn't I?
Yeah, right.
But I don't say that to people.
No.
But that's what I think it's
right.
Like. But nobody says that. You know, nobody reacts to that, which is fine. You know, it's great to be funny. And it's, you know, I'm known for doing that.
And it's how you started.
Yeah.
It's the somersaults. People weren't crying.
That's true. It's true.
You can always revert to that.
But there's I have a huge, huge wealth of all kinds.
I know. So are there any plans to do Queen of the Mist again?
I don't know. You know, the thing is, it's art. Nobody cares about art. Really.
No, I think that's right.
You know, so it was done beautifully. I don't know. I'm sure there, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein office licenses Michael John's stuff. So now that we've done it, it's a great role for a woman in between 40s and 60s. And hopefully it will be done. You know, I'd love to do it again.
Right.
But I don't know that there are any plans to do it. Like, I'd love to do it in London. But I don't think that anything is happening like that. So I have no idea. Unless they're working behind the scenes, I don't know. I don't think.
Yeah, okay. All right. Okay, so I'm not going to ask you if there's anything you'd like to do.
Well, I want to do everything, and I like doing new stuff. I this is what I'd like to do. I'd like a series. I'd like a television series.
Mm-hmm.
I would like a half-hour sitcom, because that's the easiest gig in the planet.
Right.
I could make money, I could have my weekends free,
right,
and I could have fun. And I would love that. And I keep putting that out there, and I hope that happens. But
and so do I.
Yes, thank you.
So if you're listening,
universe.
Yeah, right, Mary's a villain.
I'd like it shot in New York. That's a lot to ask, but, you know, it's possible.
Well, if you're asking, you might as well.
I may as well dream big.
Yeah, that's right. So anything else to say about the maybe being a woman in theater or just being in theater itself?
Well, being a woman in theater is interesting. My boyfriend is always saying to me, you really should direct. I don't know that I have that capacity because I know how I would approach stuff, but I think a director has an overview, that has to have an overview.
Right.
And I'm not sure that that's where my brain goes. But I have moments when I see things and I go, God, I wish you did it this way, or yeah, I wish you did it that way. So, and I think that the theater needs more women directors. And there are great women directors, but they just don't get the same opportunities that men do.
You're a remarkable person.
Oh, isn't that nice of you to say?
No, I really...
You get that just from seeing the show?
No, I got it from talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
I think that you downplay to some extent what you had to overcome to be who you are. And to give what you give. Well, I think it's true. And so I want to thank you very much for this and for everything that you do on stage that gives us all this pleasure.
Thank you so much. That's very nice of you to say.
You're very, very welcome.
It's a very interesting interview because it made me think about stuff.
I didn't make you laugh. I made you cry.
It's all good.
So there you have the remarkable, extraordinary, explosive Mary Testa. And you can hear in this interview that she brings to everything she does, including this interview, all that she is. Her passion, her energy, her incredible intellect, her candor, her honesty. She's right there with you. And of course, she's right there with you on stage. And having seen her on stage, I can tell you that if you ever get the opportunity, run, don't walk, to see Mary Testa. And I want to thank her. For that extraordinary interview. I also need to thank Josh Hackney, my intrepid IT guy, who not only makes this show as good as it is, and he does everything. He helps me with the computer, with recording, with electronics, with my iPhone, with my television, with you name it. If it's got a wire, Josh knows what to do with it. And so if you need that, you need Josh. And if you want him, you can get him at my website, where you can, of course, always also get me. TheLynnShow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. There's apparently more and more of us out there. Okay, so I hope, and actually I'm pretty sure, that you got something you can use from this show. I hope that you got inspired, but I know that even if you were not able to become inspired, you got a giggle, because Mary Testa is very funny. Anyway, I hope that you got something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, with another kick-ass interview, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure, have folks seen better days? Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell. go